Welcome to our Local Voices special presentation called A Glance Back on 94.7 KPIP LP Fayette. A Glance Back is brought to you by the Boonslick Historical Society and its president, respected Fayette community member Jim Steele, journalist, graphic designer, and local historian. Local Voices, A Glance Back, a two-hour program, airs every Monday and Friday starting at noon and then again at 4 p.m. The show focuses on the music, radio features, and history of World War II and beyond as it affected Fayette, America, and the world. Thank you for tuning in to this special edition of Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
Thank you.
It's a glance back at World War II with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
Thank you.
You are listening to Local Voices on 94.7 KPIP. Now, our local historian, Jim Steele, will take us back to the age of World War II.
This is KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. I'm Jim Steele, and today we'll talk about something everybody's heard about, or at least knows about. Everyone within the sound of my voice has either used or at least seen Fayette's historic 85-year-old swimming pool located in the city park. Now today we're going to tell you how this all came about. On a cool spring day, the first Tuesday in April of 1934, Fayette voters went to the polls to elect the usual slate of city officials, these to serve for the next 2 years. No one who cast a ballot on that day could have known that the election results would have historic and far-reaching ramifications for the local community and for Howard County. Fayette attorney D.C. Rogers, who was a 1915 Central College graduate, had already established himself as a mayor, as a mover and shaker locally and statewide. In the city election of 1934, he handily defeated the incumbent mayor to assume the city's top elected position. Immediately, the pages of the Fayette newspapers carried word of Rogers' far-reaching ideas for the city, including a major beautification effort to establish the city park, and more importantly, to have a state-of-the-art pool as its centerpiece. News accounts indicate there was near unanimous backing for the plan, and soon a number of residents had agreed to serve on official and several different planning committees. Today, the pool is particularly significant in that it continues to serve as a long-lived recreational facility built by a partnership of public entities during the Great Depression. Funding came from Fayette, the Works Progress Administration, better known as the WPA, also the County of Howard, and the State of Missouri. The pool, as you've probably noted, is distinguished by its Art Deco styling, as well as the unusual above-ground design. Now, this was the concept of one Wesley Bintz. He was a nationally known civic engineer from Lansing, Michigan, and he was the one that brought to the project his patented Bintz Pool special design. The facility opened on July 4th, 1936, Independence Day, and today remains in use in its original function. The pool's greatest significance, or period of significance, runs from, of course, 1936 until the 1960s, when air conditioning and the availability of other forms of entertainment became commonplace. It is a rare intact example of Art Deco design. The building also is a commemorative property, although not exclusively. The entrance hall was built to serve as a World War I memorial, and a plaque has been preserved as part of the pool's second floor observation area. Now, the design, or the decision to create an official city park in Fayette, came more than a century after the town was incorporated. After discussion began the year before, the Board of Aldermen, in other words, the City Council, agreed in 1935 to begin acquiring land for a park. This came at the urging of the Chamber of Commerce and other interested citizens, including Mayor Rogers. On June 18th of that year, the Fayette paper reported that the park proposal has been, in their words, under lively discussion with the Chamber of Commerce, and it's the subject of various petitions being considered at length by the aldermen. Although the initial park plans did not include a pool, the decision to build one apparently was made early in the process. Rogers, just the week before, had served as keynote speaker for the opening of a new pool in Slater, and it was noted that a delegation from Fayette also had been invited to the opening of a pool in Higginsville. It is likely that these events encouraged Fayette leaders to think for a pool. Another deciding factor appears to have been the availability of federal assistance. Depression-era government aid programs were being widely utilized in Missouri at that time on projects which ranged from hand-dug ditches for water mains to skyscrapers for public offices. The main federal sources of construction assistance for communities in the mid-1930s were two FDR, Franklin Roosevelt New Deal agencies, the Public Works Administration, otherwise known as the PWA, and the Works Progress Administration, or WPA. The WPA focused primarily on providing employment for workers who would otherwise be on the relief rolls, projects therefore intended to be labor-intensive. As of December 1935, nearly two-thirds of most WPA projects were devoted to wages. On the average, WPA funds covered more than 80% of the total cost of a project, with about 86% of funding going to cover payroll expenses. Now, in 1935, late that year, the pool was started. Missouri at that time ranked 11th in the nation in the number of WPA workers, with more than 100,000 Missourians on WPA payrolls. Now, Mayor Rogers, D.C. Rogers, who was active in the politics of municipal administration on a statewide basis, would naturally have been quite familiar with these programs. At the time the park project was being planned, he was president of the Missouri Mayors Association and was instrumental in arranging a large meeting of that group in Fayette just weeks after the park project got underway. Another well-known civic leader and local college professor was Dr. B.I. Lawrence, who also served as an officer in Howard County's Company M of the Missouri National Guard. He, too, was a strong supporter of efforts to develop the park and the pool. Now, the keynote speaker at that particular meeting was one M.S. Murray, who was the new head of the Missouri WPA. So it's logical to assume that Rogers would have pursued the subject of federal aid for the park during the time that Murray was in the area, especially since he'd recently attended the opening of the PWA-funded a pool in Higginsville. Whatever the influencing factors, it's known that by the fall of 1935, pool construction had become a key part of the park project, and the WPA had committed to help with funding. On November 15th of that year, the Fayette paper reported that 40 men had started on the park and the swimming pool project, 20 on each job. In other words, 20 with the park and 20 on the pool. In addition, an additional 20 men were put on work extending a nearby water main. Noted in the paper, plans are to proceed at once with the building of the swimming pool. Blueprints soon will be submitted to the council for approval and the actual work to begin. A week later, the city council and other officials heard what was described as an interesting and intelligent discussion of swimming pools by nationally known swimming pool designer Wesley Bentz. Apparently, Bentz had made quite an impression and was hired that same evening with a newspaper featuring a long, complimentary account of his presentation. The report included a fairly detailed discussion of the pool design and noted that officials who heard the proceedings were elated over the fact that Bentz had contacted the city at such an appropriate time. So it appears that everyone involved was impressed with the above-ground design for the pool, which was said to make it much less expensive to construct. Bentz was confident that he could stay within the approximately $16,000 budget. That's about $303,000 today. That was the amount set for the pool project. And so it appears that Fayette's pool project was off and running, and we'll finish the story next time around. This is Jim Steele reporting for KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back.
That was our Glance Back in Time with Jim Steele, president of the Boonslick Historical Society. This series with Jim Steele will continue every Monday from noon to 4 p.m. during Local Voices, only on 94.7 KPIP.
which I gaze on so fondly today were to change by tomorrow and fleet in my arms like fairy gifts fading away, thou wouldst still be adored as this moment thou art. Let thy loveliness fade as it will, and around the dear ruin each wish of my heart would entwine itself fervently still.
Taking you back to the world of the greatest generation on 94.7 KPIP.
Thank you. guys in blue, you men in khaki too, you tough Marines and nurses, construction workers too, we thank you so much. And thanks to our brave allies, the gallant Russian bear, you British everywhere, and all United Nations who are fighting over there, we thank you so much. Uncle Sam is proud of his relation. To all you folks who battle at our side, and Tojo and Herr Hitler and old Musso will soon take a ride, and I mean their last ride. So I guess that about does it, fellas. This is Bob Command Performance Hope saying so long from the USA and sending the best of the best to each one of you over there. Good luck.
This is 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back. I'm Rachel Steele. On Wednesday, September the 8th, 1943, FDR gave his 26th fireside chat, entitled On the Armistice with Italy and the Third War Loan Drive. Speeches like these by Franklin Delano Roosevelt have come to be known as fireside chats. During these radio chats, the president would inform the American people and build public support for his administration's efforts during the Great Depression, World War II, and the enactment of New Deal policies. This is President Roosevelt's 26th fireside chat from Wednesday, September 8, 1943, entitled On the Armistice with Italy and the Third War Loan Drive.
Once upon a time, a few years ago, there was a city in our Middle West which was threatened by a destructive flood in the Great River. The waters had risen to the top of the banks. Every man, woman, and child in that city was called upon to fill sandbags in order to defend their homes against the rising waters. For many days and nights, destruction and death stared them in the face. As a result of the grim, determined community effort, that city still stands. Those people kept the levees above the peak of the flood. All of them joined together in the desperate job that had to be done. Businessmen, workers, farmers, and doctors, and preachers. People of all races. To me, that town is a living symbol of what community cooperation can accomplish. Today, in the same kind of community effort, only very much larger, the United Nations and their peoples have kept the levees of civilization high enough to prevent the floods of aggression and barbarism and wholesale murder from engulfing us all. The flood has been raging for 4 years. At last, we are beginning to gain on it. But the waters have not yet receded enough for us to relax our sweating work with the sandbags. In this war bond campaign, we are filling bags and placing them against the flood. Bags which are essential if we are to stand off the ugly torrent which is still trying to sweep us all away. Today it is announced that an armistice with Italy has been concluded. This was a great victory for the United Nations, but it was also a great victory for the Italian people. After years of war and suffering and degradation, the Italian people are at last coming to the day of liberation from their real enemies, the Nazis. But let us not delude ourselves that this armistice means the end of the war in the Mediterranean. We still have to drive the Germans out of Italy, as we have driven them out of Tunisia and Sicily. We must drive them out of France and all other captive countries. And we must strike them on their own soil from all directions. Our ultimate objectives in this war continue to be Berlin and Tokyo. I ask you to bear these objectives constantly in mind, and do not forget that we still have a long way to go before we attain them. The great news that you have heard today from General Eisenhower does not give you license to settle back in your rocking chairs and say, well, that does it. We've got them on the run. Now we can start the celebration. The time for celebration is not yet. And I have a suspicion that when this war does end, we shall not be in a very, very celebrating mood, a very celebrating frame of mind. I think that our main emotion will be one of grim determination that this shall not happen again. During the past weeks, Mr. Churchill and I have been in constant conference with the leaders of our combined fighting forces. We have been in constant communication with our fighting allies, Russian and Chinese, who are prosecuting the war with relentless determination and with conspicuous success on far distant fronts. And Mr. Churchill and I are here together in Washington at this crucial moment. We have seen the satisfactory fulfillment of plans that were made in Casablanca last January and here in Washington last May. And lately, we have made new, well-considered plans for the future. But throughout these conferences, we have never lost sight of the fact that this war will become bigger and tougher rather than easier during the long months that are to come. This war does not and must not stop for one single instant. Your fighting men know that. Those of them who are moving forward through jungles against lurking Japs, those who are landing at this moment in barges, moving through the dawn up the strange enemy coasts, those who are diving their bombers down on the target at rooftop level at this moment, every one of these men knows that this war is a full-time job and that it will continue to be that until total victory is won. And by the same token, every responsible leader in all the United Nations knows that the fighting goes on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and that any day lost may have to be paid for in terms of months added to the duration of the war. Every campaign, every single operation in all the campaigns that we plan and carry through must be figured in terms of staggering material costs. We cannot afford to be niggardly with any of our resources, for we shall need all of them to do the job that we have put our shoulder to. Your fellow Americans have given a magnificent account of themselves on the battlefields and on the oceans and in the skies all over the world. Now it is up to you to prove to them that you are contributing your share and more than your share. It is not sufficient simply to put into war bonds money which we would normally save. We must put into war bonds money which we would not normally say. Only then have we done everything that good conscience demands. So it is up to you, the Americans and the American homes, the very homes which our sons and daughters are working and fighting and dying to preserve. I know I speak for every man and woman throughout the Americas when I say that we Americans will not be satisfied to send our troops into the fire of the enemy with equipment inferior in any way. Nor will we be satisfied to send our troops with equipment only equal to that of the enemy. We are determined to provide our troops with overpowering superiority of quantity and quality. In any and every category of arms and armaments that they may conceivably need. And where does this, our dominating power, come from? Why, it can come only from you. The money you lend and the money you give in taxes buys that death dealing and at the same time life-saving power that we need for victory. This is an expensive war, expensive in money. You can help it. You can help to keep it at a minimum cost in lives. The American people will never stop to reckon the cost of redeeming civilization. They know there never can be any economic justification for failing to save freedom. And we can be sure that our enemies will watch this drive with the keenest interest. They know that success in this undertaking will shorten the war. They know that the more money the American people lend to their government, the more powerful and relentless will be the American forces in the field. They know that only a united and determined America could possibly produce on a voluntary basis so huge a sum of money as $15 billion. The overwhelming success of the second war loan drive last April showed that the people of this democracy stood firm behind their troops. This third war loan, which we are starting tonight, will also succeed because the American people will not permit it to fail. I cannot tell you how much to invest in war bonds during this third war loan drive. No one can tell you. It is for you to decide under the guidance of your own conscience. I will say this, however, because the nation's needs are greater than ever before, our sacrifices too must be greater than they have ever been before. Nobody knows when total victory will come, but we do know that the harder we fight now, the more might and power we direct at the enemy now, the shorter the war will be and the smaller the sum total of sacrifice. Success of the third war loan will be the symbol that America does not propose to rest on its arms, that we know the tough, bitter job ahead and will not stop until we have finished it. Now, it is your turn. Every dollar that you invest in the third war loan is your personal message of defiance to our common enemies, to the ruthless savages of Germany and Japan. And it is your personal message of faith and good cheer to our allies and to all the men at the front. God bless them.
That was President Roosevelt's 26th Fireside Chat from Wednesday, September the 8th, 1943, titled On the Armistice with Italy and the Third War Loan Drive. Next week, we'll explore FDR's 27th Fireside Chat from Friday, December the 24th, 1943, entitled On the Tehran and Cairo Conferences. I'm Rachel Steele on 94.7 KPIP's Local Voices, A Glance Back.
Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. Though there's one motor gone, we can still carry on. Coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show, what a fight. Yes, we really hit our target for tonight. How we sing as we limp through the air. Look below, there's our field over there. With our full crew aboard and our trust in the Lord, we're coming in on a wing and a prayer. We'll be right back. coming in on a wing and a prayer. What a show, what a fight. Yes, we really hit our target for tonight. How we sing as we limp through the air. Look below, there's our field over there. With our full crew aboard and our trust in the Lord, we're coming in on a wing and a prayer.
I remember the way you used to wait. 'Twas there that you whispered tenderly that you loved me. You'd always be my lily of the lamplight, my own Lily came for sailing somewhere over there. All confined to barracks was more than I could bear. I knew you were waiting in the street. I heard your feet but could not meet. My lily of the lamplight, my own Lily Marley. Behind the line, even though we're parted, your lips are close to mine. You wait where that lantern softly gleams. Your sweet face seems to haunt my dreams, my lily.
Back to World War II with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
Thank you. Army, Mr. Jones. No private rooms or telephones. You had your breakfast in bed before, but you won't have it there anymore. This is the Army, Mr. Green. We like the barracks nice and clean. You had a housemaid to clean your floor, but she won't help you out anymore. Do what the buglers command. They're in the army and not in the band. This is the army, Mr. Brown. You and your baby went to town. She had you worried, but this is war, and she won't worry you anymore.
This is the army, Mr. Jones. No private rooms or telephone. You had your breakfast in bed before, but you won't have it there anymore. This is the army, Mr. Green. We like the barracks nice and clean. You had a housemaid to clean your floor, but she won't help you out.
To World War II with Jim Steele on 94.7 KPIP.
I just fell in love with your pretty baby face.
Thank you.
This edition of Local Voices is brought to you by Jim Steele, president of the Boonslick Historical Society, and from donations from listeners like you.